Every single nuclear power plant around Chicago must be shut down immediately. We've got an acute clinical emergency on our hands.
Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand. Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute and co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, called for shutting down all nuclear power plants at a recent conference in Chicago. We'll hear a short interview with Dr. Caldicott and a speech by a survivor of the 1979 Three Mile Island nuclear accident in Pennsylvania. We'll also hear about what happened outside the presidential debate in St. Louis and about what one doctor calls the Medicare Destruction Act. That and more, but first, a report on the most recent attack on indie media. Chris Kahatsu has the story.
On Thursday, October 7th, 2004, two web servers which provided space to over 20 independent media centers in the United States and around the world were abruptly taken offline by its internet service provider, Rackspace, of San Antonio, Texas. Rackspace was served with a commissioner's subpoena, most likely from the court in the Western District of Texas. Indie Media and its legal representative, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, are both unsure of many of the specifics of the hard drive seizure, since Rackspace has refused to provide a copy of the seizure order. Rackspace issued the statement that, quote, in the present matter regarding Indie Media, Rackspace Managed Hosting, a U.S.-based company with offices in London, is acting in compliance with a court order pursuant to a mutual legal assistance treaty. Rackspace is acting as a good corporate citizen and is cooperating with international law enforcement authorities. The court prohibits Rackspace from commenting further on this matter. Indie Media services would not seem to be covered by the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, since it applies only to illegal activities like international terrorism, kidnapping, and money laundering. Indie Media's legal representative, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has contacted the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Departments of State and Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Antonio, and the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas in an effort to independently determine the origin of the seizure order, but no agency has accepted responsibility. Beyond cutting off local IMCs from Western Massachusetts, Andorra, Brazil, the Czech Republic, Euskal-Herria or Basque Country, Galicia, Italy, Poland, Portugal, the United Kingdom, Uruguay, and multiple sites from France and Belgium, and popular internet radio streams, the hard drive seizure is also troubling in that the seizure may have violated the United Kingdom's confidentiality charter. The Independent Media Center Network is currently examining two events preceding the hard drive seizure, which may have had some bearing. On September 22, 2004, the FBI contacted Rackspace regarding some images and material hosted on Indie Media servers by the Nantes Independent Media Center of France. According to Rackspace, the FBI alleged that a particular article on the website nantes.indiemedia.org contained personal information and threats regarding two Swiss undercover police officers. The Nantes Independent Media Center webmasters determined that the post contained neither threats nor names or addresses information, as they found only photographs of the officers disguised as anti-globalization protesters. Nevertheless, the Swiss request was conveyed to the Nantes IMC webmasters, who then digitally masked the faces of the officers in the photos. The FBI followed up with a visit to Devin Theriot Orr, the registered agent for the Seattle Independent Media Center. The agents again incorrectly alleged that the Nantes article contained personally identifying information about the Swiss officers, including their home address and phone numbers. During this meeting, FBI Special Agent Eric Mueller clarified that they were not contending any laws had been broken and that there was nothing wrong with the photos of the officers, but were rather passing on a request from the Swiss government. A Rackspace manager wrote to say that she received no further communications from either the FBI or the Swiss authorities and closed the issue. There has been no confirmation that the Swiss government invoked the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty in this instance. Indeed, FBI Special Agent Eric Mueller, when contacted by the Electronic Frontier Foundation on October 12, 2004, denied any knowledge of the seizure, and inquiries with the Swiss General Attorney in Geneva, Switzerland have not led to any confirmation from the Swiss. Finally, on October 13th, Morena Plazzi, a public prosecutor in Bologna, Italy, admitted unofficially that she requested IP address log information from the Italy Indie Media server through the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, but did not seek the seizure of the server hardware. In the United Kingdom, Caroline Flint, Secretary of State for the Home Department, confirmed that no UK law enforcement agencies were involved with the seizure. This is Chris Kaihatsu reporting for the Chicago Independent Media Center.
You've all heard about the presidential debate in St. Louis, Missouri at Washington University, but did you hear what happened outside the debate? On October 8th, some 300 people comprised of Greens, Libertarians, Naderites, anarchists, socialists, community activists, and students converged to protest the debates, the two-party system, and the war in Iraq. The epicenter of the convergence was the Grace United Methodist Church, where free food provided by Food Not Bombs and free educational workshops ranging in topics from direct action to the prison industrial complex were offered. The end of the day culminated in a march through the streets of St. Louis to Washington University, where the presidential debates were being held. Protesters were met by Bush-Cheney supporters and numerous columns of police in full riot gear. As the debates went on inside, outside, in a space called the Public Viewing Area, two uninvited presidential candidates spoke to gathered protesters. A passionate David Cobb, presidential candidate for the Green Party, used a bullhorn to whip up the crowd.
Senator DeBrush, thank you very much. I wanted to give that chant because I know that our libertarians agree with no more war. I know the socialist contingency agrees with no more war. The Green Party agrees with no more war. The Nader supporters agree with no more war. We are saying, the people are saying, no more war. Folks, I'm here to tell you the Green Party is getting larger and stronger and better organized with every election cycle. And we're doing it against all odds. We're excluded from the debates. The corporate media does their best to ignore us or marginalize and ridicule our efforts. And we're living in a voting system where people feel they have to vote against what they hate rather than for what they want. And in that incredible context, the Green Party is growing. There is a growing movement in this country for peace, a growing movement for racial and social justice, a growing movement against the racist prison industrial complex and the military industrial complex. These movements are growing. Sisters and brothers, I'm going to be brief, right? How about that for a politician? The Greens are growing for a simple reason. We're telling the truth. We're willing to tell the truth about a looming ecological crisis. We're telling the truth about a system that is literally destroying our planet and creating this oppressive, racist, sexist, homophobic world order with the plunder. We're telling the truth that's very hard for some to know, but I bet y'all know. Here it is. This is not a democracy. Right? The most dangerous threat to democracy in this country is the mistaken belief that we actually have one. Today, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are not just exercising power. Sisters and brothers, they are ruling us. They are making the fundamental public policy decisions that affect our lives. We say, ya basta, enough already. Stand up, rise up, fight them in the streets, fight them at the ballot box, fight them at the courthouse. We gotta rise up together. I want to conclude with this observation. The Green Party is calling for systemic change, real change, meaningful change. Throughout all of American history, real meaningful change has followed a trajectory. You can mark it down, and it goes like this. Step one, people start talking to each other and have conversations that the elites don't want you to have. Step two, those people go from talking to organizing. Step three, organized people begin to develop a program and a platform and a plan where they say, hey, we actually are going beyond complaining to planning and strategizing for taking power, and not power over, but power with, right? A new way of thinking about power. The next step in systemic social change in this country has always been that these organized people say, hey, it's supposed to be a representative democracy. Let's go to our elected representatives and ask for some change. So, hey, come on, y'all. Let's go get some systemic change. knock on the halls of power. Knock, knock, knock. Hey, establishment political parties, we want some change. And you know what? The establishment parties have always reacted one of two ways. Either they say, oh, well, it's really sweet, and we really, like,
it's really nice what you're suggesting, but it's completely naive and unrealistic. That can't be done. Go away. Or the established parties will say, you want what? Well, you're a dangerous un-American for even suggesting it. You're a socialist. You're a communist. You're an anarchist. Today, they might add, you're a terrorist. Go away. You're not even allowed to be heard. But folks, don't you see the establishment parties have always concluded demands for systemic social change with the same response. They say, go away. And I want to conclude with this observation. I want us to acknowledge the fact. I want us to respect the fact. I want us to celebrate the fact. And I want us to be grateful for the fact that people before us did not go away.
That was David Ka, presidential candidate for the Green Party. Next up was a confident Michael Bednarik, presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party.
The Declaration of Independence says that when any form of government becomes destructive of our liberties, is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. One of the first steps in altering our government is to protest loudly and publicly. Can I hear how many people out there are unhappy with the way our government is right now? Can I hear you? Okay, what we're doing is basically drawing attention to the fact that we are not happy. We need to change this government. The Libertarian Party is all about individual rights and personal responsibility. In any situation, any decision about your life, either you can make that decision or the government can make that decision for you. Can I hear a shout from all the people who think that they are smart enough to make their own decisions in life? Excellent. Excellent. Sounds like we've got a large group of libertarians out there. I don't know how you vote, but if you have the audacity to think that you're smart enough to make your own decisions, you are definitely libertarian in your heart. Now, this whole event here, we have George Bush and John Kerry presumably debating not far from here. Now, the questions are scripted. The answers are scripted. This is not a debate. This is a Broadway play. What we are trying to do is we are trying to exercise our freedom of speech. David Cobb and I are planning to go over there towards the debate to see if we can't ask George Bush and John Kerry a few questions. Unfortunately, based on the way that things have gone, we expect that our freedom of speech is going to be limited. We expect that they are going to prevent us from getting into the debate, even though David and I are both legitimate candidates from a legitimate party. David and I have a right to have our message heard. But more importantly, the American people have a right to hear our message. Not long ago, we selected Miss America from over 50 contestants. And the office of President of the United States is far more important. How many people think that you'd like to select your President of the United States from more than just two candidates? One of the reasons that I am running for President of the United States is because I am not happy with the way things are. I cannot vote for George Bush or John Kerry and respect myself in the morning. I cannot vote for somebody who's going to continue the war. I cannot vote for somebody who's going to restore the draft. I cannot vote for somebody who's going to continue passing unconstitutional laws like the Patriot Act. I think that's unconscionable and totally unacceptable. So we are going to go over there. We're going to try to debate these people. We're trying to get the message out. However, I want to leave you with one general idea. Benjamin Franklin said that there is a difference between revolution and rebellion. Revolution is an astronomical term. When a planet revolves around the sun, it comes back to its original starting point. And according to Benjamin Franklin, the American Revolution was a change in the way that people were thinking, a change coming back to the starting point of private property and individual rights. After that American Revolution, we had to then fight for that idea, and the subsequent fighting was the American Rebellion. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to start another American Revolution. I'm trying to change the way that people think.
Capitalism.
And I'm asking you to help me. I'm asking you to talk to your friends, talk to your coworkers, stop people on the street. We need to change the way that people think about our government and the relationship with the people. Because if we don't change the way that people think, invariably there's going to be a rebellion, and I would like to try to avoid that. How many people are out there to help me change the way that people think and start another American Revolution? Can I hear you? Keep up the good work. I will continue lighting the fires of liberty one heart at a time, and David Cobb and I are going to go, and we're going to exercise our freedom of speech.
That's just what they did. Cobb and Bednarik made two attempts to enter the debates. Both candidates were arrested and brought to jail, where they posted bail and were released hours later. From the trenches, I'm Ted Forson.
I'm a presidential candidate. I'm a presidential candidate for a legitimate party.
October 15th and 16th, St. Scholastica Academy in Chicago hosted a conference titled Nuclear Power and Children's Health. Sponsored by a coalition of peace and anti-nuclear groups, the conference focused on the detrimental health effects nuclear power plants have on children. Hallways and the balcony outside the conference were lined with gruesome pictures of deformed and mentally disabled children born to survivors of the Chernobyl accident in the Ukraine. Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, says such a catastrophe could happen here. Therefore, Illinois' 14 nuclear power plants constitute an imminent threat to Chicago.
It's not if, but when there's a meltdown. Now, there are 103 reactors in America, but you're surrounded by 14, and they're pretty old, the reactors here. And if one of them melts down, that's the end of Chicago, if the wind is blowing towards Chicago.
Do you think this is should be a primary concern of Mayor Daley?
Absolutely. There could be no other more important concern for Mayor Daley, because I don't know what the risk is. Some mathematicians might be able to work it out, but it's like in medicine. You might come in, I might not quite know what's wrong with you. I have to watch you overnight. Tomorrow you might sort of manifest more clearly your disease. And we can never predict in medicine really what's going to happen to a patient. Unusual things happen, and we have to be ready for that. It's the same with these nuclear power plants.
You never hear about this in the newspapers. It's never discussed in Chicago, very rarely anyway. And when it is discussed, this issue is sort of put down like, well, people are just fear-mongering. Nothing has happened so far. Why should we be worried about this?
Well, I love that argument, nothing's happened so far, therefore, because it hasn't happened so far, it won't happen again. It's like, well, I haven't got cancer so far, you know, I won't get cancer. Or I had an old man who came into me years ago in the emergency room. He'd broken his neck, and he was nearly dead. And he said, I've been driving for 60 years, and I've never had an accident. But he did that night, you see? And if there is an accident, and there's a possibility that there could be, and it's not low, then what are you going to do when you've got hundreds of thousands of people with acute radiation sickness, you know, with severe nausea, vomiting, bloody diarrhea, their hair falling out in big clumps and dying within 2 weeks of massive infection or hemorrhage? I mean, they can say, well, you know, it hadn't happened before, but now it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Some people would say, well, your problem is that you have no compromise. You just want to get rid of all nuclear power, and there has to be a compromise somewhere.
I don't have a problem. I'm a physician. I have no problem. I took the Hippocratic Oath. Nuclear power is medically contraindicated, not just because these reactors pour out millions of curies of radiation in an unregulated way every year, but because there could be a meltdown, which could mean the end of Chicago, and because these reactors can create massive quantities of radioactive waste, hundreds of thousands of tons, which are going to last for up to a million years. No one knows where to put it. And this material is very biologically active. If strontium 90, for instance, leaks into water, which it will over time, and gets into the food chain, it bioconcentrates thousands of times at each step. And unfortunately, or fortunately, our senses weren't evolved to be able to taste strontium 90 in fish, or to smell it, or to see it. So we don't know when we're eating radioactive material. Like if the power plants that put out routinely all this radiation into the air every day, if you could see it, you'd understand. If you could smell it, you could understand. But you can't. It's invisible and tasteless and odourless. And in that sense, it's so dangerous. And then when your cancers appear, they don't wear little signs saying what made them, like when you ate some strontium 90 in a piece of fish 20 years ago, or cesium-137, that the cancer does not identify its origin. But there are more and more reported cases of cancer clusters around old nuclear power plants now, because the incubation time for cancer is any time for 5 to 60 years, whereas for a cold, it's 2 days. For measles, it's 3 weeks. And that's how the nuclear power gets away with its perfidy, because A, these materials cannot be picked up by the human senses, are undetectable, and B, because cancers do not identify their origins. But almost certainly, these nuclear reactors, 103 of them in America, are contributing to the increased rates of cancer, and particularly in children who are very much more sensitive to radiation than adults. Mm-hmm.
The energy industry says that it's not practical to get rid of nuclear power, that we've put so much investment in it that now we're getting 20% of our energy from it, so there's no way we can make that up any other
way.
That's
ridiculous. If you all stopped using your clothes dryers and hung your clothes out in the sun in the summer and by your furnace in the winter, then much of the electricity made from nuclear power would not be necessary. If you decided to conserve, turned off every light in your house except that in the room in which you're operating, turned off your TVs, your VCRs, your computers at night, and stopped being so wasteful with energy, you would have the same standard of lifestyle as you have now, because the Europeans use 50% less electricity than you do and have the same standard of living. Anyway, nuclear power is totally subsidized by the federal government. You can't buy insurance for a nuclear accident for yourself or your house or your property. That says everything. The enrichment of uranium is paid for by the federal government, extraordinarily expensive and energy-consuming. Nuclear power makes global warming gases, contrary to what the nuclear industry is saying. It makes massive quantities of carbon dioxide throughout the whole fuel cycle. It makes 93% of the chlorofluorocarbon gas, which is the main destroyer of the ozone layer, and also a very potent global warming gas. And then continuously, as I've said, it releases massive quantities of radiation in an unrestricted way into the air every year. So what the nuclear industry says is a lie. And I believe that the FCC and the FTC must step in, because we can't have terribly medically dangerous industries telling lies to the American people. And that's why the physicians have to take a stand and say this is medically contraindicated. Every single nuclear power plant around Chicago must be shut down immediately. We've got an acute clinical emergency on our hands.
That was Dr. Helen Caldicott, president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Her newest book is The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. The worst nuclear accident in the U.S. happened at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania in 1979. That accident galvanized the anti-nuclear movement, and no new nuclear power plants have been built since. The government contends that no one was harmed by the accident, but many, including Mary Osborne Osai, a longtime resident of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, near the Three Mile Island facility, have documented the many casualties of that accident.
Unless you lived through the terrifying days and weeks of the accident at Three Mile Island, you'll never be able to understand or relate to how we felt then and how we feel now. Sounds, smells, voices, and words have been etched within us. The voice of commentator Walter Cronkite on the evening news announcing the accident to the world and to Harrisburg. The sounds of sirens or church bells ringing instantly flashes back to March 30th, 1979, known as Black Friday, a day of uncontrolled radiation releases and evacuation. The incredible metallic taste or smell, the saltiness, the thiosulfate peroxide smells, and the dead fishy smell remind us of something evil that destroyed our happy way of life. We remember the voices of our children and our inability as parents to protect them from the invisible, unforgiving poisons in our air, and remember our neighbors downriver exposed to the radioactive reprocessing grade water dumped from TMI into the Susquehanna River, from which their water for drinking and bathing was obtained. Other voices introduced us to the second disaster at Three Mile Island, exposing dishonesty and betrayal by those entrusted with protecting our health and safety. The utilities' Jack Herbine telling us that everything is under control, and later finding out from the lieutenant governor that it's not under control, that we'd been lied to. And the voice of Governor Richard Thornburgh on the third day of the accident, who reluctantly advised those most susceptible, the pregnant women and preschool-aged children living within 5 miles of the reactor, to evacuate, while ignoring those of us living beyond the 5 mile zone receiving doses as though there was a magic wall that would stop the radiation. Even voices that we didn't hear had an impact. The mountains of transcripts and audio taped voices of the NRC commissioners, who never wanted responsibility to order any evacuation then and who still don't want that responsibility now. Voices kept silent at the NRC, knowing leak rates were falsified for 1.5 years prior to the accident at TMI. Those voices never ordered MedEd to shut down the reactor as required by their own laws. During the first days of the accident, we did not know that solid reactor fuel was melting into liquid and flowing like hot olive oil, or that TMI was venting, burping, and dumping radioactivity into our communities, our river, and our bodies. But our bodies knew, and the animals knew. Our bodies reacted by displaying symptoms and effects: the metallic taste or smell, burning or reddening of skin, burning in nose or throat, itching or tearing of eyes, the nausea, vomiting, subsequent diarrhea, and hair loss. Birds died, many of our pets and farm animals died, and many were born deformed. Flowers and leaves started growing deformed and mutated, and many trees died. They continue to do so. To this day, the symptoms have never been investigated. To this day, the nuclear industry prostitutes continue to deny that TMI caused harm to any living thing. If Three Mile Island didn't do it, then what did? Nothing else ever happened in central Pennsylvania to cause those effects. Thousands of people during the accident called the governor's hotline, and Three Mile Island Alert had a telephone log listing a full range of radiation symptoms. A state representative wrote a letter to the NRC asking why they refused to look into these effects. The NRC's Harold Denton issued the now classic response that not enough radiation escaped to cause any of the effects reported. Living on the bank, the west bank of the Susquehanna River, Bill Widdock, who was the first civilian eyewitness to the accident, was startled by the roar of steam blowing out of TMI around 4 a.m. Bill had the metallic taste, developed skin cancer, and his wife developed breast cancer. They were plaintiffs in the consolidated personal injury lawsuits, which the attorneys reluctantly had to withdraw from because the judge threw out all the expert witnesses. Bill died of cancer. While preparing to milk the cows, Marie Holoka of Zion's View was engulfed by a strange blue air. She was choked and could hardly breathe. She fell to the ground. She was sick for days. Many of her cows died after the accident, and guinea fowl eggs would not hatch. Marie developed a thyroid problem, breast cancer, and later cancer around her heart, and she has also died. Louise Hardison had many problems after the accident. Goats, chickens, cats, and rabbits died on her farm across the road from TMI. Stillborn lambs and some rabbits were deformed. They didn't have all their legs. Louise has also died. Her farm was sold, and mutated dandelions still grow in the unfarmed pasture. On a hill 8 miles northwest of TMI, dentists Klein and Malcote found that all of their dental x-ray films taken of their patients' teeth for the first 2 days of the accident were fogged or banded. They taped new film on the front door for the next week and found nothing wrong with those. So they concluded they received the highest doses during the first 2 days. Farmer Claire Hoover and his wife Ruth lost 12 cows and 9 calves shortly after the accident. Some of the animals were taken to the New Bolton Center lab to find the cause of death. The results never came, and neither did the bill. And they learned later that the state had paid the bill. Other tests conducted showed their cattle were found to have elevated white blood counts, the eosinophils. Coincidentally, a group of doctors at Hershey Med Center also found many of their patients had this elevated white count. In 1985, the Hoovers and their children received out-of-court settlements in the first round of lawsuits for over $200,000. The Hoovers were Mennonites. The church asked them to stop talking about TMI. The milk company told them to quit talking about their problems with the animals or they would not buy milk from them. Eventually, out of 100 cows, 27 died or had a problem, those that were in the pasture. Most calves died. The cows that were in the barn were okay. Their St. Bernard dog and pony died later due to respiratory problems. Helicopters flew over their farm, and someone always knew when to take away a dead animal. One time they hid a calf and had their vet autopsy it before the NRC could find out. They also hid the remains. It had damaged lung, damaged liver, and lungs that never opened. McDonald's used to buy the cows at auction, and the government bought the cows from McDonald. The Hoovers found this out by inquiring why they never received their paychecks. Fran Kane, who still lives across the road from the cooling towers at TMI, had the metallic taste. She later had a poodle puppy born with no eyes, and she received an uncontested settlement during the first round of lawsuits. Bill and Darla Peters, who Steve Wing spoke about yesterday, had a bitter metallic taste so strong they couldn't drink enough water to get rid of it. They had burnt skin and noses, and Bill got blisters on his nose and lips. Their dog and cats died, and later, while mowing, he found enough dead birds to fill a hydraulic bucket half full of dead birds. Bill died during his deposition for the lawsuits. And one of the attorneys had the nerve to say it was okay because we still have his wife, Darla. Charlie Conley's cows died. The hop toads disappeared, as did the bumblebees that pollinated the clover. The cooling tower drift used to blow over his trees, and at times the leaves would turn black as desiccated. Many trees just died on his farm. And about 5 years ago, so did Charlie. On Herb Meyer's farm in New Cumberland, sheep would not dilate during birthing to deliver their young. Sometime later, a double-headed stillborn calf was born, and the vet told Herb to have it mounted because if he didn't, nobody would believe him. Herb died of thyroid cancer shortly after the 10th anniversary of the accident, and his family did not sue. 10 miles away from Three Mile Island in the northwest direction, a wave of hot air engulfed Jean Trimmer as she leaned over her porch railing calling her cat. Shortly thereafter, her skin tingled and started to itch, and later her skin appeared reddened like a week at the beach. She got tiny white bumps on her skin, and her beautiful black hair started falling out. When her hair grew back in, it had white hairs growing in a salt and pepper effect. Jean developed a rare kidney illness. During the evacuation, nurse Becky Meese's baby had projectile vomiting and severe diarrhea. The hospital in Ocean City said it could be radiation poisoning and suggested she have her car checked for contamination. She did. It was, and so was her purse. Later, her child developed cataracts and other health problems. Debbie Baker just found out that she was pregnant during the accident. She lived in the vicinity of the dentist film office where the dentist film had fogged. Debbie's son Bradley was born approximately 9 months later with Down syndrome. The lawsuit on his behalf was the largest out-of-court settlement for over $1 million. The accident at Three Mile Island was not a one-day or one-week disaster. TMI burped and vented radioactive poisons upon us during the accident and throughout the decade of cleanup. The symptoms were real. We did not imagine the metallic taste. And contrary to the NRC's opinions, we do not have hypothetical children.
That was Mary Osborne Osai speaking at the Nuclear Power and Children's Health Conference held in Chicago, October 15th and 16th. Osborne Osai continues to live in Harrisburg. She showed pictures of deformed flowers, plants, and trees that grow in her yard and the area around 3 Mile Island. We're coming to you from the trenches. While some still question George Bush's legitimacy as president, others are questioning whether he has even been the acting president. John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, spoke in Chicago last month about his book, Dick, The Man Who Is President. Nichols says there's a reason why Dick Cheney delights in his low profile.
He has risen to the point where he runs the most powerful country in the world, and yet nobody knows it. And I'm going to take a couple minutes tonight to kind of lay out the case, because I think even those of us who might be progressives and who really do follow the news and care about things might doubt that Dick Cheney actually is as in charge as I think he is. But let me just give you an anecdote, one of my favorite ones. I start the book out with it. After the Florida recount debacle, Bush stayed down on the ranch in Texas. Cheney moved up to suburban Washington. Even during the recount, before the Supreme Court had decided the election, Cheney was working out of an office in suburban Virginia where he, and a reporter actually went in at the time and saw, he would sit at a desk with cell phones, like a group of cell phones just spread across the desk, as well as two landlines, and it was constantly ringing. He was talking to everybody. I mean, this guy was working like crazy. Well, what was he doing? He was peopling the administration. And if you want to take a look throughout this administration and see the one continuity, the one thread that goes through it, it's Dick Cheney. Paul Wolfowitz. Fife. Scooter Libby. Antonin Scalia. All of these people, everybody, all in these places of power, all longtime friends and associates of Dick Cheney. Paul O'Neill over at the Treasury. Boy, was that a mistake on Cheney's part. But the fact is, he moved people he knew into all the key positions before Bush even showed up in Washington. Bush comes flying in on January 20th. But you would think, how many of you have ever had a job? Okay. How many of you, start a new job? I don't know about you, but when I start a new job, I try to make a good impression, right? You kind of maybe come in a little early, work a little extra, try and get your job, just be there all the time, right? 3 weeks after Bush and Cheney arrive in Washington, an accountant from Terre Haute, Indiana, went nuts. Guy didn't like IRS forms. And if you've been an accountant, I don't know, any accountants in the room? It can really whack you out after a while. So he heads out to Washington, D.C. with a gun. And he is just really angry about all sorts of stuff. And he's outside the gate to the White House, and he starts shooting. It's 11 in the morning, crowds around, everything. He starts shooting at the White House. Now, I want to recommend to you that this is not a wise move. The Secret Service, they just don't go for that. And so you start shooting a gun outside the White House, a lot of people wearing suits not unlike this gentleman's come whipping out of the White House, and they're shooting at you. He survived. He got in a mental hospital. But when somebody starts shooting outside the White House, starts popping off the gun, even before September 11th, the assumption was he might not be alone. Could be a terrorist incident. So Secret Service's job is to secure the principals, the president and vice president. They run in, a team of Secret Service agents run into the White House to secure him. Now, they go to Cheney's office. Well, no problem there, right? Dick Cheney is at his desk. It's 11 in the morning. Brand new administration. So much to do. Still, remember, only 10 days after Dick Cheney took the chairmanship of the Energy Task Force. No easy job, So he's there at his desk. He's got three aides with him. He's got two computers on. There's a television on as well with CNN. He has phones on the desk, papers everywhere. It is the classic image of a CEO absolutely in charge and working his fingers to the bone to make sure that he gets everything done. So, you know how Secret Service agents talk, right? Always into their sleeve. And they go, backseat is secure. Because that's his Secret Service code name, backseat. He always rides in the back seat. They go, back seat secure. He says, okay, well, what about number one? Everybody's like, well, where's Bush? Right? Yeah. So they're, you know, they rush into the Oval Office, right? The SWAT team is here. But the Oval Office is empty. So they're all like talking, where is he? You know, they're scared. What's going on? Finally, the agent, you always have an agent right at your side. Radio and says, I got him. You know, and they say, where? Sector 4. You know, so they rush over, right? They've got to secure. They got to make sure the president's secure. And they find him in this sector, the White House gymnasium. 11 a.m., 3 weeks into the administration, there's George Bush working out on all the machines in the gymnasium with a good-sized sweat going. He had been there for 2 hours. Understand, folks, that you don't have to be an investigative journalist to start to figure out what's going on in this White House. George W. Bush has taken more vacations than any president in history during his first term, more than 200 days. George W. Bush has campaigned more than any president in the history of the country in his first term, been on the campaign trail more than any president in history. And George W. Bush, have you seen the guy? You take a look at him. He's in fantastic shape. He's almost 60 years old. Take a look at that man. He's as buff as you can be. That man spends 2 hours a day in the gym. So if you're on vacation more than any president in history, if you're campaigning more than any president in history, and if you're carving out 2 hours for the gym, and if, as we know, George W. Bush doesn't sleep well at night, he always travels with his own special pillow. And seriously, he likes to go to bed. Laura talks about this. He likes to get to bed by 8 o'clock in the bedroom, right? So what? He's starting to carve the day out quite a bit there. I mean, where is the time to do anything? The answer, of course, is that there is somebody doing something every day. Dick Cheney, chair of the Energy Task Force in the most energy-obsessed administration in history. Dick Cheney, chair of the committee that vets judicial appointments and all the legal initiatives, working on a daily basis with Karl Rove. Dick Cheney, the man who vets all of the tax policy, up to the point where, when the classic thing in O'Neill's book, those of you who haven't read Paul O'Neill's book, it's almost as good as mine. But O'Neill's book, right? O'Neill says that after the 2002 election, Cheney and Rove are sitting around, and O'Neill's in the room, and of course they're talking about what they're going to do with the spoils of America. They had won the election, they got to do what they want. And they're talking about a big new tax cut. And George W. Bush, the president of the United States, supposedly, comes wandering in, as he might, you know, and says, hey guys, what's going on? You know? And Cheney says, well, we're talking about, you know, we got this big win here, we're going to do another big tax cut. And O'Neill recounts this. Bush goes, well, didn't we already do a tax cut? And then he starts kind of waxing philosophical. You know, if we do another tax cut, people are going to start saying we're just giving it all away to the rich. And Cheney reaches over, according to O'Neill, puts his hand on Bush's and says, George, stay on message. So, Energy Task Force, judicial appointments, tax policy. And there's a little thing, a little war going on. You probably haven't heard much about it, but there's a war going on in Iraq. And if you looked at any revelation that's come out of this administration, it has been that Dick Cheney was talking about going to war in Iraq from January 20th on. But the one thing that Richard Clark and Paul O'Neill and so many people got wrong was that they claimed that Dick Cheney started talking about Iraq long before 2001. Go back to the, we're talking about debates this week, right? Go back to the 2000 debates. I did this for the book. Went back and looked at all three presidential debates and the vice presidential debate. Do you know what George W. Bush said in the presidential debates when asked about foreign policy? He said, I don't believe that we should be in the business of nation building. I don't think we should be sending troops all over the world and telling other people how to run their country. So you watch all those debates, that's where Bush is at. Then you watch the vice presidential debate. For the better part of 10 minutes out of an hour and a half debate, Dick Cheney discussed the need to do something about Iraq in excruciating detail. This is a man who was obsessed with Iraq going back to 1991. So we have energy policy, judicial appointments, the whole moral agenda, tax policy, regulatory, obsessed with Iraq. If you take a look at where Cheney's focus, where his obsessions are, you can see the exact definition of this administration. But what you cannot see, no matter how hard you look, is any evidence of George Bush.
That was an excerpt of a speech by John Nichols, author of Dick, The Man Who Is President, speaking at Barbara's Bookstore in Chicago on September 29th. Thanks to Mitchell Stepinchik for bringing us that talk. There's a link to the whole talk by John Nichols posted on our website at www.chicago.indymedia.org. Coming up, the Medicare Destruction Act. We're coming to you from the trenches. In 2003, Congress made massive changes to the Medicare program. Although titled the Medicare Prescription Improvement and Modernization Act, critics say it's not an improvement at all. Dr. Sid Bild, a Chicago physician, spoke at the College of Complex's free speech forum last month about what he calls the Medicare Destruction Act.
This act is really a monster. Its design is to destroy Medicare, but it was written by the medical industrial complex, which persuaded the Bush administration over a period of several years to finally introduce it in December of 2003. It was signed by President Bush. Now, most of the focus has been on the prescription drug aspects. And so I want to talk about that first. H.R. 1, which is what the bill is also called, starts out with a premium. It will go into effect in the year 2006, and I'm going to talk mostly about that bill, because although that's the main part of the bill, although parts of it really started in July of 2004, there are attempts to provide prescription cards. But I want to jump over to the year 2006 because that's when the main thrust of the H.R. 1 takes place. It starts out with a premium of a person who wants to get a prescription card, which would be available through the U.S. government certification. Cards will be made available. This is not insurance, but with a card, prescription card, one would pay $35 a month to start, and each month thereafter, if the person is to remain enrolled. There is a deductible of $250 to start the prescription drug card in operation. Anyone who has prescriptions that start to mount beyond $250 will find that they will have to pay 25% of the cost of those drugs, and the card will cover 75% up to the amount of $2,250. So there will be coverage of 75% by the card, and 25% will come out of pocket. After a person spends $2,250 worth of prescriptions, you then fall into what is called the donut hole. And from $2,250 to $5,100 in drug expenses, there is no discount whatsoever, and all coverage up to $5,100 inclusive comes out of pocket. If expenses go beyond in a given year $5,100, the card will cover 95% of expenses, and only 5% would have to come out of pocket. But the process is repeated yearly, which means that a person would have to have expenses which go well beyond $5,100 very quickly in the year for a person to get any real benefit out of the card. Most people, and the drug company actuaries have figured this very carefully, will find themselves trapped in the donut hole. The amount of money, $2,250 to $5,100. Now, having gotten a card, that's not the end of the story, because what one has to do with the card, assuming that one feels they want to spend the $35 a month and pay the $250 deductible, they then have to look at what card will cover what drugs. And the way one does this most efficiently is to go on the web using a computer to figure out. You can call the government, call the U.S. government, Medicare, and they will assist you in this, presumably. And what one has to do is to find out which of 73 cards which are going to be made available, and they haven't been defined yet which ones they're going to be, is going to cover your particular prescriptions. Now, all cards are supposed to cover all types of drugs, all families of drugs, but not all drugs that are available. There are some 4,200 drugs that are available in the United States that come from some 250 drug companies. So, for instance, all the cards are supposed to cover the statins. Each one will have a statin, but not necessarily for cholesterol, but not necessarily all of the various kinds of statins. Regarding blood pressure, they will have, each card will cover, for instance, something called an ACE inhibitor, but not all the ACE inhibitors. Now, you have to know that all ACE inhibitors and all statins are not the same. People can take one and not another. And these drugs are very potent, and there may be life-threatening questions between Zocor and Lipitor, for instance. So that it's really important to find out which of these drugs is going to be suitable for a person. So having gotten a card, and let's say you're on four different medications and you find them all on card XYZ, and you sign up for it. The law that will just pass, the Prescription Drug Improvement Act of 2003, permits the card company to change the actual drug that they're going to cover weekly. So they also are able to change the discount that is made available to you weekly. And you cannot change your card for a year. So to maintain the card, you have to pay $35 each month. So the card conceivably could be worthless after 4 months or 3 months. And you are stuck with it. You cannot buy another card and have it work. You have to stick with that card for a year. That's the law. The law does nothing about control of the prices. The drug companies are allowed to charge whatever market price they set. The government is prevented, Medicare is prevented by the law from bargaining with the companies for a lower price, as for instance, the VA does when they service veterans. They are able to achieve up to 80% discounts. These cards that are available to Medicare recipients, which are the elderly and people with disabilities, they are not permitted. The government, Medicare, and the cards, companies themselves, are not permitted to bargain for lower prices. In addition, the law specifically bans getting your drugs from foreign countries. If you do that, you cannot sign up for these various drug cards. The drug cards themselves are relatively worthless after a period of time because the price of the drugs are permitted to rise, the deductible is allowed to increase, the premiums are allowed to increase, and if a person who is healthy at, let's say, age 65, decides not to purchase a card for $35 a month because they're not on any medication, they will be penalized when they finally do choose a card. They will be penalized 1% per month for the time when they were eligible. Just today, the papers are talking about a program which is in this H.R. 1 bill, which calls for $500 million to be set aside for some 50,000 people who will be selected, some by lottery, for specific chronic illnesses that have very high cost drugs. I'll give you an example. For rheumatoid arthritis, which is one of several illnesses that are covered, the drug Humira costs $19,000 a year. The Medicare card and the program that is instituted under HR 1 would pay for $12,000 of the 19, and the person would only have to pay $7,000. The drug company and the plans do not call for the company that makes Humira to lower its price. They accept the market price as the price that they're willing to pay. And in this case, Medicare has set aside, the plan takes $500 million out of Medicare, set aside for this program to see if it will work for these some seven or eight different illnesses in which there are high-cost drugs, for which the government will pay full price, but will give some discount to the individual. This is the kind of thing which is designed to drain Medicare of its funding. Let me explain briefly, and I think I'll end with this after this. Medicare has currently three parts to it, A, B, and C. Part A is the hospital plan, and this is what is covered. This is paid for by deductions from payroll, and it covers all the expenses basically that a person has if they're hospitalized. Part B is the plan that pays for doctor's expenses, for visits in the hospital and as an outpatient, and it also pays for outpatient tests. Plan B, or Part B, is paid for 25% out of Social Security. 75% of Part B is paid for by Congress. Part C, Medicare, is the HMO part of Medicare that has been in existence for about 7 or 8 years. The Medicare HMOs, which used to be 13 in Chicago, there's only one operating in Chicago, and that's Humana. They've all kicked the seniors out of those plans. Those plans, you should know, in addition to the premiums that one has to pay, for instance, Humana Gold Plan charges about $140 a month to belong to that, also receives from Medicare $7,200 a year for everyone that's enrolled out of Medicare. And in the year 2005, Medicare HMOs, which are going to be called something different, they'll be called Medicare Advantage, but it's really a Medicare HMO. Those HMOs are going to be paid $8,200 each year for every enrollee, plus the premiums that people will have to pay. And that increased amount of money, plus the drug supports through Medicare, will cause the Medicare funds to go down, and anyone remaining in old Medicare, the original Medicare, who doesn't want to join an HMO, wants to keep their own physician, will find the fund more and more getting depleted and becoming less and less valuable, to the point that people will say, I don't want to be in Medicare anymore, I will have to go for this other. And that will be the end of Medicare. That's the direction that the Republicans have driven the program. And so there is much more to be said about this, but what we are calling for is the repeal of HR 1, the so-called Medicare Prescription Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003. Repeal it and simply enact coverage in Medicare Part B for prescription drugs, and you would have the Medicare population, of which there are approximately some 45 to 48 million people in it, would find their prescription drugs covered. And I think that's the way to go. And thank you very much for your consideration.
That was Dr. Sid Bilt speaking at the College of Complex's Free Speech Forum on Saturday, September 11th, 2004. We'll be right back. From the Trenches is produced by Chicago's Independent Media Center. You can find us on the web at www.chicago.indymedia.org. Listen again on the fourth Monday in November for another report from the Trenches.